Ladies and gentlemen, before a huge audience of men of the 2nd Marine Division, Fleet Marine Force, Camp Elliott at San Diego, California, Bristol Myers, the makers of Ipana for the Smile of Beauty, and Sal Hepatica for the Smile of Health, present It's Time to Smile with Eddie Casper.
Let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
With a nostalgic nod toward the Atwater Kent, we now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Tonight, tribute to the memory of Eddie Cantor.
Thank you, Harry Von Zell, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, here we are broadcasting from Camp Elliott with an audience of 1,500 Marines. You know what a Marine is?
Yeah, well...
A Marine is a large body of man entirely surrounded by women.
Oh. Well, now, Eddie... That's a new definition, but I've always been under the impression that Marines are exceedingly tough.
Tough?
Yeah.
Tough? You betcha. These Marines are so tough, they eat their meat raw and then sit in boiling hot water to cook it. You know, Harry Von Zell, Harry, you know they have two Marine stations here, Harry. Camp Elliott and Camp Linda Vista.
Oh, well, which place has the most Marines in it?
The Rainbow Gardens. Quite a place, Harry. They've got a sign over the cloakroom, not responsible for hats, coats, or Marines left over 30 days.
Yes, sir. When they play, Eddie, they play hard, but they do take their work seriously.
Oh, you're right, Harry. You should have seen them this afternoon when they had their war games.
War games?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, Harry. A lot of them get around in a circle, and one guy starts shooting. He throws out a couple of cubes with numbers on them, Harry.
I don't know, Eddie. That sounds pretty dangerous to me.
It is, if the cubes are loaded, yeah.
Oh, dice, huh?
Yeah, now you know what the government means by keep them rolling, yeah.
Well, Eddie, you certainly have learned a lot here today.
Well, Harry, among other things, I learned that the defense workers here in San Diego are working with such speed that they don't stop for a single minute. If you're near one of those defense plants, keep moving. I stopped in front of a defense plant this morning for 2 minutes. Right away, a guy slapped wings on me, stuck a propeller on my nose, painted U.S. bomber on my back, and there I was, a Popeye P-38.
Now, you must be kidding about
no,
that.
No, Harry. Practically everything out here has been turned into defense machinery. Everything is the... This morning, I stuck a nickel in a pinball machine, started to shoot, and so help me, the machine started to shoot back. Yeah, is that the phone?
I think I heard the phone a minute ago.
Hello? Hello? Eddie Cantor speaking. Hello? Hello? Hello?
How do you do?
Russian. You should be in San Diego. Why aren't you here?
I was detained because I had to kiss my wife goodbye.
Well, why should that detain you?
I waited for a blackout.
The legend that was Eddie Cantor touched many people during the decades of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. We have asked two men who were intimately acquainted with Eddie Cantor on the radio to narrate this two-week tribute to the man with the banjo eyes. Alan Reed played many roles on the Eddie Cantor programs during the 30s and 40s, including the voice of an orchestra leader whose magic violin was a part of the program, but whose voice had perpetual mic fright, David Rubinoff. Harry Von Zell replaced Jimmy Wallington as Cantor's announcer and straight man, and held that position through the end of Eddie's radio career. These two gentlemen will lend their recollections to our tribute.
Well, I have a great many memories of Eddie. I first went to work for him in 1933, I believe. I think that was the year I first joined him, playing odd bits, all kinds of things. And almost immediately, it was Rubinoff time. Dave Rubinoff was the orchestra leader on the show, and he couldn't talk, and Eddie wanted to build up regular characters on the show so there could be a building relationship so that character could be built and he could take advantage of character for jokes. The best example of that is Jack Benny's tightness. All he had to do is say one word because it's so well established and the laugh comes. Well, he wanted to build similar characters, and one of the things he did was build Rubinoff. Harry Von Zell, of course, was his straight man, as it were, and Jimmy Wallington before that, and they became characters on the show.
There was a time in Eddie's life when his health wasn't the best. As a matter of fact, those famous eyes of his, you know, that he could do such things with, he learned rather early in life that there was a thyroid condition that indicated possible serious developments at rather early age. And I'm talking it was at a time when he was still in his early 20s. And a surgeon had spoken to Eddie, and he said there could be performed surgery that would correct that situation. And for example, said this thing that you have with your eyes, the enlarging of your eyes, this tendency to pop, says it'll correct that. And he said, it'll change my eyes? Forget it. Now, here, this describes the man, Eddie Cantor, totally. He was only thinking of one thing, his public. What he was saying, what would Eddie Cantor look like if he came out without these eyes? Can't do that. The fact that it might have a very serious bearing on his future life and the state of his health didn't even occur to him. And he went on all of those years.
Hello, Eddie. Gosh, I rushed over as soon as you phoned me. What's all the excitement?
Harry, I'm thrilled.
What?
Life magazine is sending over a photographer to take pictures of me.
Oh.
They're going to give me a two-page spread. Isn't that fine, Harry? Think of it. Little Eddie Cantor in life.
Yeah, it would be better if there was a little life in Eddie Cantor. But, Eddie, listen. Now, come here. Why did Life magazine decide to take pictures of you at this time?
Well, they heard that one of the studios is after me to do my life story.
You?
What's the matter, Harry? Why are you so surprised?
Look at him.
You? Yes, me. After all, they took the life of Cole Porter and put it on a screen. They took the life of Al Jolson and put it on a screen. Don't you think they should take my life?
Yeah, I'm in favor of it.
I'm not finished yet.
That's what you think.
Oh, Harry, don't be so smart.
I'm sorry.
Already I'm working on the script of my life. The early days, my meeting with Ida.
Yeah, might be interesting at that. Have you got a scene showing how you proposed to Ida?
Who proposed, Harry?
Who didn't propose?
At her house one night, I kneeled down to tie my shoelace, and before I could straighten up, she said, I do. Her father borrowed $10, and her mother moved into my apartment.
Well, how long ago was that?
35 years ago, and the minute he pays back the 10, out they go.
35 years. Listen, wasn't that about the time Al Jolson became a star?
Yes, Harry.
Mm-hmm.
And you know something?
What?
He had a great influence on my career. I idolized Jolson. When he sang in my Merry Oldsmobile, I got myself a car. And when he sang April Showers, I went out and got rubbers and a raincoat. And when he sang California, Here I Come, I got a home in Beverly Hills.
Yeah. Didn't he used to sing Sonny Boy?
Yeah, but Ida wasn't listening. Oh.
Well, listen, Eddie, if Jolson had such an influence on you, how is it you never use him on your radio program?
Oh, well, what's the sense of getting Jolson? We both do the same thing, sing, tell jokes.
I know, but Jolson has a style of his own. For instance, when he sings, he gets down on his knees.
I can get down on my knees.
If Jolson can get up. Look, if that studio is going to make the story of your life, they better hurry. You're not getting any younger, Eddie.
Well, look, Harry, always remember a man's age is determined by the condition he's in. The years have nothing to do with it. A man is as young as he feels.
Mm-hmm. Eddie, how do you feel?
I want to lie down a while.
Listen, Eddie, I don't want to argue with you about it, but I happen to know that you've already celebrated your 35th anniversary in show business.
All right, so I'm a little over 35. You know, when I started in the Ziegfeld Follies, I was only 3 months old, Harry.
How could you be on the stage at that age? You were still in diapers.
No, for the Ziegfeld Follies, do you need more?
I know that there will be people, and perhaps some of them listening to them now, who in the profession have come at some time to know and to work with or have to do with Eddie Cantor, and some of them will say he was sometimes a difficult man. That he was sometimes tended to be aggressive and rather stubborn. Rather cantankerous. Well, in all honesty, I have to say that Eddie could be. He could be difficult. Eddie was what you call a fighter. When he felt that what his judgment was telling him, what he intended or wanted to do was right and would prove to be right, he was a hard man to whip. And sometimes he fought when it wasn't really necessary to fight. It wasn't all that important. But what people have to know about a man like Cantor is what makes him a fighter. Here is a man who, from the very first day he could react intellectually or emotionally to anything, he had to fight to exist. No mother, no father, a very loving, very loyal grandmother was a great influence for good in his life. But the area in which he was brought up, in the ghetto, in New York, well, I'll put it this way, that most of the people that Eddie Cantor grew up with as a child either went to the electric chair or died out of the bullet of a gangster's gun. This was his beginning. People who knew him and worked with him will remember that he bore a very heavy scar which ran from the center to the hairline of his forehead down to the bridge of his nose. Obviously a very old and very deep clefted scar. This happened when Eddie was about 7 or 8 years of age. His grandmother, of course, being his only means of support, had to go to work. She worked in a garment loft in New York to provide. Every morning when she left for work, she would give Eddie a nickel. This nickel would buy him a piece of sausage, as they called it. It was a little piece of salami, a cut of salami, and a loaf, as they called it. This loaf was a large, hard-crusted roll. This was his food for the day. Now, on this particular day, Eddie had gone to the little shop where he got his salami, and of course, he was a good customer of the place, so the cuts were more generous than they might have been with a different customer. And he was walking with the sack down an alleyway, and an older and larger boy came up to him to take his sack and his food from him. And Eddie fought. And in the process of the fighting, this older boy picked up the metal lid of a large trash can and smashed it into the head of little Eddie and split it asunder. It's not a pretty picture, but maybe it explains the influences in the life of this little boy that made Eddie Cantor a fighter, and sometimes a fighter that people couldn't quite understand why he had to fight so hard for so little.
You know, the more I think of it, Eddie, the more convinced I am that a motion picture based on your life story would be an inspiration to the youth of America.
Thank you, Harry.
Yes, sir. It'll prove that a man can rise from humble surroundings and reach the top of the ladder without any talent whatsoever.
Go ahead, Bonzo, laugh. But I did come from humble surroundings, and to us kids, raised on the east side of New York, life was no joking matter. I shall never forget one Christmas when me and my best friend, Georgie Jessel, were just a couple of youngsters.
Oh, Andy! Hey, Stinky!
What do you want?
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Your father's mustache. Hey, you want to help me shovel snow?
Huh?
My mother told me to be sure to shovel all the snow in front of our house.
Yeah, but you've been shoveling snow for an hour. How long you have to keep shoveling snow?
Till I find me old man.
Hey, you want to go down to the pool room?
What, and be a juvenile delinquent? Nah. Besides, there's no fun down at the pool room. Somebody swiped all the pool balls.
Yeah? How do you know somebody swiped all the pool balls?
What do you think I got hanging on me Christmas tree?
See, you got a Christmas tree, huh? Hey, you got anything to hang on to a tree that'll light up?
Yeah.
What do you got that'll light up?
Me father's nose.
Your father's nose don't light up.
It will when we stick his toe in the socket.
Hey, look, Eddie. There's that girl who's stuck on you, that Ida Tobias. Let's show off in front of her, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I know what let's do. Let's make snowballs and see who can throw it the furthest, huh?
Bet you I can throw further than you.
Okay. One, two, three.
Yeah! There, I hit Schultz's window. What did you hit?
Schultz.
Eddie did it.
Georgie did it.
It must have been you, Eddie Cantor. You can go to stuff further than anybody I know. That'll cost you a buck, or I call the cops.
Oh, don't do that, please. Eddie has no money.
You keep out of this, Ida Tobias.
Oh, please, mister, don't call the cops. Take this dollar for the window.
Okay. Now beat it, all of you, and stay away.
Well, Eddie, ain't you gonna tank Ida?
For what? For paying off my debt and embarrassing me like that, I should thank her. I think I'll take a smack at her at that.
Oh, Eddie, I think you're the worst boy in the whole world. I never want to see you again as long as I live.
Now you see what you look, what you went and done. She was only trying to be nice to you, Eddie, and you made her feel bad. Look at her over there, bawling her head off. Don't you think you ought to do something to make her feel good?
Yeah. I think I'll marry her.
I believe Eddie started in 1913. I think that that was his beginning as Bits. Now, before his first vaudeville job, he would sing in an amateur show on the east side of New York. He would Maybe he even had a job. I'm not sure of this, but I seem to recall vaguely somewhere in the background he had been a singing waiter in one of the downtown saloons. The Bowery saloons, I guess. I'm sure as everyone breaking into show business in those days would work in 900 different directions. Hustling. You had a run in show business and in New York in those days, and eventually you grabbed something. I'm not as old as Eddie was. I came into it at a similar time. I entered show business for the first time in 1922. Before that, 21. Anyway, he started there, then got this job probably 2 years or 3 years after that with the vaudeville team I mentioned. Then he went on for a long time playing all of the small circuits in vaudeville and then graduated to the big time. There were any number of vaudeville circuits in those days. Vaudeville was the key entertainment at that time. And there were houses, or rather circuits, that would, like, say, would give an act of 10, 12 weeks. The cheapest of them was the Gus Sun Time, which was out of Chicago and around the Middle West. And I know that Eddie worked the Gus Sun Time. You'd start that way and work up, and finally you'd get to the Lowe's Time. Lowe's had theaters all over the country and could give about 35 weeks of work to an actor. And then the big time was Keith, which later became Keith Albee, B.F. Keith and Keith Albee. And they would supply a man with 40 weeks' work on a tour all across the country, booked and solid, and that every year he'd know that he'd have this route. They'd have 3 or 4 stars in a bill. When you got to the Palace, which was the home and the top place of every actor wanted to play the Palace, as you know, they would have 5 or 6 stars on a bill. They would have men on the and women in the Palace who would be the sole top draw in Podunk and other places. Although the Keith Time, of course, was not little bits of towns. It was the big cities all over the country. It combined out here on the West Coast with the Pantages Time. So Eddie went through vaudeville, and then Ziegfeld grabbed him because he was very clever and worked in sketches and songs. He had his own very animated style of singing. He was all over the stage, and he just smothered an audience. The hand clapping and the jumping. I'm sure you've seen him work. Haven't you ever seen him? He would get very enthusiastic, and he'd jump and skip all over his shades and clap his hands if you knew Susie like I knew Susie. Oh, you know, he'd jump all over.
Eddie, what are you doing here so late?
I gotta come in and talk to you, Ida. It's important.
Oh, well, you can't come in, Eddie. My father's sleeping.
I won't wake him up. We'll sit on the sofa.
That's where he's sleeping.
Well, let's go out here on the fire escape. Let me help you. There you are.
Gee, it's dark.
Who hung this flag up here?
Oh, that's my father's flannel underwear.
Oh, I thought it was funny. A flag with a flap in the back?
Well, Eddie, what did you want to talk to me about?
You know, Ida, in the spring, a young man's fancy lightly turns to thoughts of love.
Why, Eddie, that's Shakespeare.
Shakespeare? I'll kill that Georgie. He told me he made it up. Just wait till I...
Eddie, it's getting late.
Wait a minute, Ida. I'll tell you. Ida, of all the girls I have ever gone out with, you are the only girl that I've gone out with, that I've loved, of all the girls that I've gone out with. Alone. Together. I think.
What are you trying to say, Eddie?
Well, I'll come right to the point. Ida, there comes a time in every man's life when the time is ripe to tell a girl that this is the time when the time is ripe. What time is it?
It's 10:15.
I think I'll go home. No, it's now or never. Ida, I got a surprise for you. Stick out your engagement finger. There. How do you like it?
Oh, Eddie, it's beautiful.
Isn't it, though? See, it's even got a hole on the top for a stone.
Oh, gosh, it's lovely. It must have cost you at least $7.
I paid $22.50 for it.
$22.50 for that hunk of brass?
Brass? He told me it was gold. I'll kill that Georgie.
Well, Eddie, did you get married to Ida right after you proposed?
No, Harry, not right away. You see, even in those days, I had my pride.
Your pride?
Yes, the marriage license was $2, and the least I could do was to pay for my half.
Oh.
Besides, Ida's father couldn't see me at all. He had a feeling I was just a bum, a loafer.
Well, did you tell him that you were an actor?
Yeah, then he was sure of it. To prove him wrong, I started my first vaudeville act, Harry. It was in an old vaudeville house, and I had an act to match. Wait till you see this on the screen, Harry. Ladies and gentlemen, for my next bit of entertainment, I will present the Eastside Police Court on a busy Monday morning. In this scene, I play all the characters myself. Everybody rise. Here comes His Honor, the judge.
The first case on the docket,
Mamie Jessup. You're charged here with disorderly conduct, assault and battery, and resisting arrest. You beat up 2 policemen, took away another's club, stole 1 officer's badge, and finally tossed the sergeant over a horse car. Well, Mamie, speak up. What about it?
Your Honor, I couldn't help myself. I did it in a moment of weakness. I'll tell you how it happened. I went to Coney Island with my boyfriend. We sat in the saloon and had 15 glasses of mother-in-law whiskey.
Mother-in-law whiskey?
Yeah, Old Crow. Boy, was I flying.
Well, after the 4th drink, why didn't you order sarsaparilla?
After the 4th drink, I couldn't say sarsaparilla.
Fine, $5. Court's adjourned.
Oh, brother. And from that act, you made a living, Eddie?
It may sound corny to you now, Harry, but believe it or not, that act kept me off the stage for 2 years.
Well, when did you marry Ida, then?
Well, I told you the license was $2 and she had $1.
Yeah, but what about your pride?
I lost my pride when she found another $1. Harry, I'll never forget that wedding ceremony. It was quiet and solemn and simple.
And do you, Ida Tobias, take this man, Edward Cantor, to be your lawful wedded husband and promise to love, honor, and obey him as long as you both shall live?
I do.
And do you, Edward Cantor, take this woman, Ida Tobias, for your lawful wedded wife, to love, honor, and obey as long as you both shall live? Do you, Edward Cantor, take this woman?
I do! Close the window, those darn kids with their firecrackers!
Let me see if I can reminisce of a tale he told me of how he got started. He was working as a stooge, playing little bits, carrying on and off stage juggling devices for a team of jugglers whose name I do not recall. He was working for them. He decided that he would work in blackface because blackface was a vogue. He didn't do this in the beginning, but suddenly decided, I'm going to try and be a character instead of just being a fella carrying, juggling things on and off. And he came on and did a little cute, quick step and made a little funny noise on his exit. And he started building on this, and the jugglers, who were vaudeville headliners, they were more than jugglers. I've forgotten the name. Juggly was part of their act. But they were headliners, and he was a guy, and they paid him a salary, and eventually he said, I'm going to stay in this all my life unless I do something about it. So he one day prepared a whole routine. And while they were juggling, nobody watched the jugglers. He was doing his whole routine. And he had and he'd made sure that there was a booker out front the day that he decided to do the routine. And he got himself some small-time booking on his own as a single. And that's the way Eddie Cantor had his beginning. And you mentioned to me that Harry Von Zell had told you that Eddie had guts and the Jewish phrase for that is chutzpah. And this was something that I guess he inherited from his grandmother, who he had, call it guts, intestinal fortitude, drive. He would let nothing stand in his way when he was on the way up. The very fact that he took these people who were paying him a salary, you know, and just said, the heck with that, I'm making my bid, this is it, is one example of that. I'm sure that all through his career and all through all of his dealings, he rode roughshod over some people. And no human being is perfect, and especially those who are exceptionally successful in this dog-eat-dog world that we still live in. Somebody had to say, well, look, maybe if I'm a tough guy and hard now, later on I'll get to a point where I can do a lot of good.
But the years have been good to us. Just think. 37 years ago, I was a poor boy living in a cheap tenement house on the east side of New York. And today, I'm on the radio, I'm in pictures, I'm also a producer. Do you know what I'm going to do next?
What, Eddie?
Move out of that cheap tenement house.
Oh, now you're kidding.
Yes, I am. But, well, do I recall the first place we lived? Harry, it was in the Bronx. And that's where the stork started calling on us. Of course, the stork has branches everywhere. But the Bronx, that's his headquarters. But as things got better and the family got bigger, I bought a home out in the suburbs.
Yeah, that was about the time you were working for Ziegfeld, wasn't
it? Yes, the great Florin Ziegfeld. Each year, he had a new Follies, and Ida had a new girl. And I remember each new production, 1915, Baby Marjorie. 1917, Baby Natalie. 1919, Baby Edna. 1921, Baby Marilyn. She was a small baby. Then came number 5, Little Janet. It was in a hospital in Brooklyn, the night of October the 8th, 1928. I was sitting in my favorite easy chair.
Your favorite easy chair?
Yeah, I was there so often they made it mine. Suddenly the door opened.
Eddie Cantor?
Yes, doctor.
Congratulations, you have another baby girl.
I knew Ida would never be satisfied until she had a basketball team of her own.
What did you say?
Never mind. What do I owe you, doctor?
Nothing, Cantor. This one's on me.
Well, wasn't it about a year after that you lost all of your money in the market crash, Eddie?
Yes, Harry. The savings of a lifetime. I was a pretty dejected man. I remember coming home to Ida wondering how she would take it.
Hello, Eddie. I read the evening papers. Is it true?
Yes, Ida. It's all over. They took everything.
Not everything, Eddie. They didn't take away your sense of humor.
They couldn't. That's the only thing I didn't have on margin. Ida, I don't know what to say.
We're not as young as we were when we were first married.
Don't worry, Eddie. We'll start all over again, right from the very beginning.
No, no, Ida, no, no.
But then, later, during the Wall Street crash of 1929, Eddie Cantor had already become a big star with the Ziegfeld shows and had made a fortune. He had invested and made practically all of his stock investments in a single stock. And that was one of the stocks that hit the bottom and literally wiped Eddie out. And Ida told me the story some years later that he came home a completely beaten. His spirit was destroyed. He could never sing again. He couldn't do anything. He was just simply completely demoralized. And Ida did nothing but listen to him. And she didn't sympathize with him. She said, I knew this wasn't Eddie talking. This was a different man. And she said, I just sat there looking at him as if I was looking at a stranger. And he became angry about it. As Ida put it, he made quite a tzimitz, which is, I think, a Yiddish word explaining what amounts to a mess. He made quite a to-do. The fact that I didn't seem to be reacting in a normal manner to this catastrophe, he had just made the announcement to me that we were poor, poverty-stricken. And all I said was, Eddie, said Ida, you're a young man. You're a boy. You're still a boy. You did it once. You can do it again. Quit crying. Go back to work.
Heard a sermon, what a sermon, preached by Parson Brown. Tell it to ya, tell it to ya. Told each mister, told each sister, time to settle down. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Potatoes are cheaper, tomatoes are cheaper. Now's the time to fall in love. Why, the butcher, the baker, the old candlestick maker gave their price a downward shove. Grab yourself someone to fry your eggs and bacon. She can live just like a queen on what you're making. You'll find it sunshine or trouble, you're better off double. Now's the time to fall in love.
If the market takes another slump, I know thousands and thousands of married men who will have to leave their sweethearts and go back to their wives. Nowadays, when a man walks into a hotel and requests a room on the 19th floor, the clerk asks him for sleeping or jumping.
Suites are much cheaper, movie seats are much cheaper. Now's the time to fall in love. A talkie seemed tender to make her surrender. You should take advantage of. When the pictures overtake her where it's quiet, just remember what the hero did and try it. You're not a Coleman or Gable, but do what you're able. Now's the time to fall in love. Potatoes are dearer, tomatoes are dearer, but what they've got to do with love? As long as you've got a shoulder to hold her, she'll know what you're thinking of. If you've tried out every trick you know to win her, don't you worry about the cost of any dinner. Love may not be nutritious, but boy, it's delicious. Now's the time to fall in love.
Harry Von Zell.
What, Eddie?
You know, this place is getting me. I've been here all afternoon. I've been doing a lot of serious things, Harry, and I've made up my mind. I've decided to join the Marines. I've really decided, Harry.
You?
Eddie,
I think that's very swell, but the Marines want men. Or women, not you. What makes you think the Marines will accept you, Eddie?
Well, listen, Harry, a lot of Marines want Hedy Lamarr, but they'll settle for Martha Ray, believe me. He'd settle for Edna May Oliver.
No, but really, Eddie, you're much too old for the service.
What do you mean, too old? There's nobody too old to serve his country. Why, when George Washington fought at Valley Forge, he was 45.
And how old were you at the time?
I was a baby. Shut up! No use trying to talk me out of this, Harry. I've already sent for the doctor here, and I'm going to take my physical just as soon as he arrives.
But
there's no use...
Hello?
Oh, doctor, I want an examination. I'd like you to take a look at my physique.
Physique? Are you kidding?
What? Don't worry about me, doctor. Just give me the examination.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Will you, Cantor.
Will you give me the toughest marine test that there is? Just give me anything that you give these fellas you can give, believe me.
Well, it's rather strenuous for a man like you, but if you insist, very well. Get down on your knees and begin.
Yes. 1, 2, 3, a Larry. 4, 5, 6, a Larry. There you are. I picked up all the jacks.
Congratulations. You are now a Marine.
Yep.
Do you feel all right?
Well, that'll give you an idea how I feel. I'm a little winded, but don't worry. I regret that I have but 6 jacks to pick up for my country.
All right. Now, there's only one thing more, Mr. Cantor. I have to give you a blood test.
Blood test?
Yeah.
Well, okay, I'm not afraid. Just unpack your needle and let's go. I can take it. I'm tough. I'm...
Hey, doctor, he's fainted here. Fainted? That's funny. I didn't even unpack my needle.
Where am I?
Well, take it easy now, Eddie. He looks very weak, doctor. I'd better put him in this bed here.
A good idea. I'll get a nurse to take care of him.
Oh, gee, Harry, I'd love to be a Marine.
Here's your nurse, Commander.
Well, it's Gracie Allen. Why, Gracie, you're a nurse?
Well, Eddie, you've got nothing to worry about. Just do as I say. If you do as I say, I'll have you flat on your back in no time.
You mean flat on my back?
Well, don't get excited. You know what I always say, time wounds all healed.
Look, I can't understand, Gracie, how you ever became a nurse.
Well, it's very simple. Nurses run in my family.
They do?
Yeah, my father chases them. Sometimes he catches them.
Yeah.
But sometimes my mother catches him. And then you should see what he catches.
Yeah, boy! Gracie, if you're going to be my nurse, tell me, how much experience have you had?
Why, well, you're the 9th patient I've had this week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, if you don't believe me, you can ask Mr. Davis.
Who's Mr. Davis?
Well, he's the one who's still alive.
Oh, that's fine.
Well, you see, you're in good hands. Well, last week a friend of George's had pneumonia, and it took the doctor 2 whole days to fix him up.
Yeah.
And the next day that same fella caught a cold, and you know what I did in 15 minutes?
What?
I nursed him right back to his pneumonia.
Will somebody get her out of here? Gracie, is George Burns here with you?
No, it's the maid's night out, so George had to stay home and hold hands with the butler.
Look, Gracie, will you please go away? I don't want a nurse. I am not sick.
Oh, do you always have a purple face like that?
Purple? My face is purple? I must have a fever. Quick, you'd better get a thermometer.
Well, who needs a thermometer? I've got a special gadget for reading temperatures. It works just like a weighing machine.
Look, Gracie, I don't want to...
You simply put your feet on this scale. I stick a penny in your mouth, and a cog comes out of your left ear.
Gracie, I'd rather use a thermometer.
All those thermometers are too complicated. Now, Nursey knows best, though. Put your tootsies on the scale.
Oh, please, don't do that to me.
Oh, that's fine. Now, open your mouth.
Open my mouth?
Eddie, open your mouth.
Oh,
Andy, I only want to put in a penny, not a half dollar.
Number, please.
Oh, operator, get me Mr. Cantor's temperature.
Thank you.
Ouch! Gracie, turn this thing off, will you?
$5,000 on the first shot.
Yep. Yeah. What does it say, Gracie?
You are ambitious, handsome, and in the best of health. Temperature, 104.
104? Why, that's crazy. I happen to know that I'm only 99.
Well, you can't expect this machine to guess your age, too.
No. No, I said my temperature is 99.
Oh, it is? Oh. Operator, you gave me the wrong number.
Sorry, I will refund your penny.
What was that?
Well, on wrong numbers, you get a free ball of chewing gum.
Gracie, will you go away? Will you go away from me?
What's the matter, Eddie? Don't you like me?
Please, don't misunderstand. I love you, honey, but I don't want you to nurse me.
Oh, well, if that's the way you... Do you really love me? You're sweet.
Oh, Gracie, it isn't that I love you.
What?
I said it's just that I like you. You see, I like you.
Well, you don't love me anymore?
But...
Well, you said you did a minute ago. Fickle, aren't you?
I'm not fickle, and I never meant to say I love you. I just...
Is there someone else?
Look, Gracie.
Is there?
Yes, there is.
I bet it's Ida. Vamp.
Listen, you're speaking of the woman I love.
Well, if you love her so much, why don't you marry her? Get it over with.
Yeah, but I did marry her. I did.
You a married man and making love to me. Oh, wait till my husband hears about this.
All right, Gracie, I give up. I'll do anything you say. Will you nurse me back to health?
Oh, now you're being sensible. Now, first I'll give you something for your diet. Here, eat this.
What was that?
What did it taste like?
A thermometer.
Oh, you've eaten them before, huh?
You mean you gave me glass to eat?
Yeah.
Why, you're crazy.
Well, I didn't eat it. You did.
Now, look, Gracie.
Oh, okay. Hello? Who is it you want? Yes, this is Gracie Allen. What's that? Oh, my goodness. An emergency at the Del Mar Hotel. Well, I'll take care of it right away. Say, Eddie, where can I find a Marine?
A Marine? Just one. Why, there are 1,500 of them right here.
All I want is one, and he has to rush right over to the Del Mar Hotel.
Why? What's going on there?
500 sailors are fighting one Marine, and he wants to find a friend to hold his coat.
Wait till you hear what we say about you guys next week. Fellas, I want to tell you that... I shouldn't tell you this, but... Gracie Allen has donated her check for this broadcast to the men in service. I want you to...
I think it might be a good idea to tell you about some of the people that Eddie introduced. He had he'd bring proteges on, and they'd never been on before. And they were Deanna Durbin, who went on to become a great big star, and Dinah Shore. And...
Look, I'd like to hear Dinah sing first.
Yeah. Good. How about Buttons and Bows?
Oh, I'd love it. While you were away, Dinah, I used to listen to that record of yours on the jukebox every day.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
Harry, let's listen to Dinah sing now and save a nickel together.
East is east and west is west, and the wrong one I have chose. Let's go where I keep on wearing those frills and flowers and buttons and bows, rings and things and buttons and bows. Don't bury me in this prairie, take me where the cement grows. Let's move down to some big town where they love a gal by the cut of her clothes. clothes, and I'll stand out in buttons and bows. I'll love you in buckskin or skirts that I've homespun, but I'll love you longer, stronger, where your friends don't tote a gun. My bones denounce the buckboard bounce, and the cactus hurts my toes. Let's vamoose where gal keep for you the nose, silks and satins and linen drape shows, and I'm all yours in buttons and bows.
I love you in buckskin or skirts that you've homespun, but I love you longer, stronger, where your friends don't want a gun.
My bones denounce the buckboard bounce, and the cactus hurts my toes. Let's vamoose where gal keep for you the nose, silks and satins and linen that shows, and I'm all yours in buttons and bows.
Silks and satins and linen that shows, and you're all mine in buttons and bows.
Give me Eastern chamois where women are women, in high silk hose and peekaboo clothes and French perfume that rocks the room, and I'm all yours in buttons and bows. Buttons and bows. Buttons and bows
and flowers and buttons and bows and rings and things and buttons and bows.
Bobby Breen was very big for a while. Only that, Pocococcus, the Mad Russian, he took characters and built them on his show, and they became very big. Pocococcus, Einstein, went on to have his own shows, and Pocococcus became a national character. So did the Mad Russian, so did Rubinov, for that matter. I would get booked into vaudeville, and they wouldn't know me from Adam, the audience, but underneath the name would be in parentheses, the voice of Rubinoff, an Eddie Cantor show. And boom, when I came on that stage, there was instant recognition and acceptance, you know, and it was a big, big thing. That's followed me, incidentally, through my whole career. I've had to build characters, and the characters have become far better known than Alan Reed or Teddy Bergman, as I was in those Eddie Cantor days.
The good that the man did in his lifetime is immeasurable. He was compassionate, not only in his expressions of compassion, not for public reaction. I know that for many years he was the sole support of a boys' camp in the East. He didn't go around asking for donations. Only when it came to the time where the demand upon the capacities and the facilities of the camp were such that it just cost more than any one man could afford. And at that time, Eddie would appeal to his friends, and they responded. But it was a long time before anybody knew that there really was such a camp. And if they knew there was such a camp, that it was Eddie Cantor who originated it and who had sustained it for so many years. I don't know how many. It was Eddie Cantor who took to Franklin Delano Roosevelt that idea which evolved into the March of Dimes. He went to the president. He said, "Mr. President, I have a thought. You know, my business is knowing something about people, and you always will get generous contributions from people of affluence, people of wealth, to your appeal in the cause of research into the frightful consequences of infantile paralysis, polio." But he said, "There are millions and millions and millions of people out there who just want to give. They can't all give dollars, but they can give pennies, dimes, and they will. Have a public thing. So I'll do it on my own. I'll do it on my program. A march of dimes. Just ask people, if you can, send us a dime. Well, good heavens, that brought in more money. You see, people who hadn't thought of it, well, surely with Mr. Roosevelt, the president behind it, and the fact that he himself was a victim of this frightful disease, and there was no question but what they were making progress and getting results. So there were a lot of people who just didn't give because they weren't directly hit. But when Eddie Cantor came out and said, this is everybody's job. Everybody has a child they don't know and will never see. It needs help.
All day today in Hyde Park, New York, thousands of men, women, and children have filed reverently past a shrine and looked upon an inscription which reads, born January the 30th, 1882, died April the 12th, 1945. For this is the 65th anniversary of the birth date of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And this is the shrine where now he sleeps, forever with the immortals. But there is another shrine where Franklin Roosevelt lives with the living, with tiny boys and girls who find in his memory and achievements the inspiration to go on and overcome the obstacles of twisted limbs, to triumph over the ravages of infantile paralysis. This shrine in Warm Springs, Georgia, and in similar places all over the country, is a testimonial to man's humanity to man. You created it, ladies and gentlemen. You, at his request, started the March of Dimes so that little children might walk. Let us dedicate ourselves to the perpetuation of that cause. Let us honor the dead by serving the living. Keep those dimes rolling. Keep our children walking. Give and keep right on giving.
Brother, can you spare?
For listening, ladies and gentlemen, and be with us again next Thursday, won't you? When our guest star will be your favorite of mine, Cary Grant. And in the following weeks, our guest will be Charles Boyer, Van Johnson, and then on February 27, be sure and listen, because we have on one program Georgie Jessel and the one and only Al Jolson. So listen in next Thursday for Cary Grant, and in the meantime, remember,
I love to spend Thursday with you, past friend to friend. I'm sorry it's